top of the deaths at work, we also have a high number of non-fatal accidents and practically no protection for workers on very demanding physically and psychologically jobs. Private companies must be given strict rules when doing workplace safety risk assessments, and their managers have to be severely punished when they fail to observe these rules.
Unions are demanding that the workplace safety issue seriously enter the political debate and that the country's work system finally comply with the EU safety standards. Max Civili, Rome.
On Friday, Amir Abdullahian met with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri, and caretaker Foreign Minister Abdullah Abu Habib. Both sides discussed the latest developments as well as challenges facing Lebanon on various levels. The issue of Saudi-Iranian rapprochement seemed to be a significant additive, which experts believe could prove constructive.
Any rapprochement between the countries of the region is in the interest of Lebanon. Saudi-Iranian agreements are a positive step, and they benefit the entire region, and they confront the U.S. ambitions and interests. We know very well that it was the U.S. that opposed this reconciliation, and they always stand against any rapprochement between any two countries in the region.
Iranian experts say Tehran's goal is to have a wider scope of cooperation in the region for the sake of mutual understanding among regional states.
Iran wants to use its bilateral relations with different countries in the region in order to create a multilateral format for cooperation. For example, to work with Saudi Arabia on helping Lebanon or helping Syria or helping Yemeni issue. The vision which is aimed by Iran is strengthening these bilateral and multilateral cooperation against any external interference in the region.
Iran's foreign minister has stressed that Tehran will not hesitate to provide Beirut with any necessary need, but without any interference in Lebanon's internal affairs. Iran's foreign minister has always stressed in all his visits that the election of a president is an internal Lebanese issue. He also suggested that a positive Saudi perspective toward Lebanon could help break the deadlock in the presidential crisis. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Netherlands and Denmark are the only EU nations so far to have supplied F-16 warplanes to fight the Russian army. Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba told his EU counterparts on Thursday that more countries need to follow suit. He also claims sanctions against Moscow are being circumvented and need to be tightened up.
We should deprive Russia of the capacity to produce missiles and drones. We see that the production is increasing and they use Western elements, Western spare parts in it.
Experts say EU sanctions against foreign nations are set to become even less effective as groupings like BRICS expand further.
They see it as a momentum to say, okay, this is payback time. We are going to show the world that we are capable to build a strong, unified bloc together with Saudi Arabia, Iran, United Arab Emirates. This bloc, if it is well managed and well elaborated on, has a huge potential.
EU defense ministers have been told to ramp up their training of Ukrainian soldiers.
I still think that we have to do more and faster. And I propose the ministers to raise the objective of the mission to 40,000 Ukrainian soldiers trained by the end of the year.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban insists Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. As an EU member, Hungary says it will block a proposed 20 billion euro financial package for Ukraine. Orban wants peace talks. Many others do too, as the EU is faced with a growing social crisis. Anti-war campaigners say it is disgraceful that the EU is now in an arms race with NATO, claiming the bloc has moved from being a peace project to a full-scale military operation. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On the anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri reminded the nation of Sadr's legacy, stressing that the only way out of any crisis is unity among Lebanese people. but he called on all parliamentary blocs to participate in a seven-day dialogue in parliament, after which there would be open-ended sessions to elect a president.
Dear Lebanese, exactly 1 year has passed since my call on the parliamentary blocs on the need to realize a national agreement by electing a president who unites and does not divide, a president who is supported by the Christians, but also by Muslims, and who is before all this a nationalist. Such an accomplishment could assist Lebanon in exiting its economic crisis.
45 years after his disappearance, Imam al-Sadr is still seen as the main founder of resistance against the Israeli occupation, while also representing unity among the Lebanese people.
The legacy of Imam Musa Sadr did not only not die, but it overgrows all the periods of Lebanon. And every time we have a crisis, we remember that only his teachings and what he was calling for can represent the salvation for this country.
This is a very sad day for us. Had Imam Sadr been alive today, we would not have had all these problems we are seeing today. We would not have had these political, economic, or social problems. But we promised him that we will continue his path.
Imam Sadr founded the Lebanese Amal Hope Movement in 1974 and openly worked for the rights of the oppressed and the lower class in Lebanon.
Musa Sadr, the Lebanese Imam, represents all what does Lebanon represent. The unity, the ableness of living together, Muslims and Christians, the willingness not to surrender in front of evil. That's what Musa Sadr represents. They intended by kidnapping him to erase all his existence. His existence continued.
It's an opportunity for the Lebanese to remember what the Imam Sadr stands for as far as unity and peace and one country united for its own people.
The prominent Shiite cleric disappeared on August 31, 1978, during an official visit to the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Lebanon still holds former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi responsible for his disappearance, along with two of his companions, while blaming the Libyan authorities for concealing details which could uncover the fate of Sadr.
45 years on, and the case of Musa Sadr's disappearance remains unclosed. The people of Lebanon unanimously believe that this is not a lost cause, for his legacy and the values of resistance and justice which he fought for have not died down. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Over 600 Sunni clerics, scholars, and thinkers from different parts of Iran took part in a meeting with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to share their thoughts on the issues facing the Muslim world. The meeting was held on the occasion of the Government's Week in Iran. Addressing the meeting, Iran's president said a united Muslim society is the biggest obstacle to global arrogance.
An organized, coherent, and united society moves towards a clear and purposeful destination. Having goals and being dynamic are the main characteristics of a nation. A united society and Islamic Ummah is the biggest obstacle to the global arrogance and the system of domination. And this is the biggest obstacle to the dominators. After World War II, when two power blocks were formed in the world, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the hegemonic powers considered the unity of Muslims as the only obstacle to their dominance. Therefore, they always try to take measures against the Islamic world, but unity is the best solution to counter such measures.
Sunni and Shia religious scholars and elites believe that global arrogance is seeking to sow discord among Muslims by creating obstacles, launching propaganda campaign, and forming tech theory groups. But the Islamic Ummah should be vigilant to foil all the plots.
Such a meeting provides a good opportunity to offer better practical solutions for forging further unity and convergence between Shia and Sunni. The government of the Islamic Republic does not believe in any separation between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Dr. Raisi believes that both Shia and Sunni Muslims are of one essence. Accordingly, good achievements have been made in the economic, political, and social status of Sunni Muslims in the country.
Regarding the existing commonalities among different sects of Islamic schools of thought, such a gathering would send out this message to the enemy that Muslims are united and they cannot easily create discord among Shia and Sunni Muslims.
If all Muslims get united and join hands, no enemy would dare to sow the seeds of discord among them. The enemies do not want Muslims to make progress, but if we are united and support each other, the enemies cannot do anything.
The participating Iranian Shia and Sunni elites and scholars unanimously believed that what they all have in common is to think about the country's national interests and problems, which can certainly discourage the enemies.
Iranian officials and the scholars attending this event believe that creating unity among Sunni and Shia Muslims is indeed a strategy for the Islamic Republic of Iran to help foil the plots hatched by the enemies of the Islamic world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The United States is on a record annual pace for mass shootings, averaging two such incidents every day this year. High summer temperatures, soaring economic inequality, a nation awash in guns, and with lax supervision over them, there seems to be a universal belief that the epidemic of mass shootings won't decline anytime soon. But there is increasing anger over which mass shootings get political attention and which do not. Every day, 120 Americans are killed with guns, and more than 200 are shot and wounded. But the recent murder of three black people in Florida by a white racist was immediately seized upon by the political classes, even though domestic far-right extremists killed just 25 people last year.
As I made clear in my inaugural address, white supremacy is a poison. It's a poison. It's been allowed to grow faster and fester in our communities to the point where the intelligence community is determined, the U.S. intelligence community is determined that domestic terrorism rooted in white supremacy is the greatest terrorist threat we face in the homeland.
Shootings at schools also get massive attention. But what goes repeatedly ignored are the victims at the most common site of debilitating gun violence, poor neighborhoods.
It's a tragedy when these things are happening. But when those things happen, they usually happen in these white schools and these rich neighborhoods. They're getting funding, they're getting support. The media is talking about it. The world cares about gun safety. But we're talking about it on a daily basis, and no one cares. I had a 13-year-old say, I carry a gun to school because I want to make it there safely, not because I want to hurt somebody. I think that speaks volume for a 13-year-old to be able to say something like that. And I think those are the situations and stories that need to be told. And those are the ones that need to be invested in. And how are we able to make that shift and make that happen?
Gun control is a constant media topic, but there is almost no discussion about the economic and social redistribution programs which have been proven to reduce mass shootings in poor areas.
The investment is not going in the right spaces. They invest so much, so heavily on the policing aspect of it, and they've done that for decades, and it's repeatedly proven to not work or make a difference. Building community together, getting God up to there, they've never seen, taking them off the block, taking them to other spaces, and investing that money and putting money in their pockets and teaching them skills at the same time. And that's the aspect and component that's missing.
The U.S. gun homicide rate is 26 times that of other high-income countries. Their economic inequality is the highest of any nation in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the so-called Club of Rich Countries. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Almost 3 years after he was given the all-clear by pharmacy regulator, the General Pharmaceutical Council, pro-Palestine activist Nazim Ali's fitness to pursue his career as a pharmacist is being questioned again by the same regulator.
A tribunal at the regulator's headquarters here in Canary Wharf, East London, has been tasked with establishing whether or not Mr. Ali's words, such as Zionists are not Jews, which he spoke at a 2017 Al-Quds rally in the British capital, were, quote, objectively anti-Semitic.
The hearing was pushed for by what's collectively known as the Zionist lobby in the UK, pro-Israeli organizations with a penchant for going after pro-Palestine activists.
It's a deliberate sort of attempt at conflating and making the water muddy, as it were, that distinction between anti-Semitism and sort of anti-Zionism or anti-Israel speech. And they're deliberately sort of muddying the water. They're using the IHRA definition, and they're sort of throwing as much as they can to confuse things. And it's a way of sort of silencing speech.
Nazim Ali, a pharmacist of some 30 years, is but one example of how the Zionist lobby weaponizes anti-Semitism to silence critics of Israel. Other recent examples are former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, the rapper Low Key, and Bristol University professor David Miller. Also present at the hearing, Mr. Ali's family, who have experienced his ordeal with him every step of the way for the past 6 years.
Well, it most certainly hasn't been easy when you see your father plastered over different news outlets online and in print media, with headlines and photos that aren't the most flattering, that represent him in a very negative light. I can't go on the record and say that people are lying, per se, but certainly there are many falsities that are out there that have been published against him that cause a lot of frustration. And one day we hope that justice will be served, not only in the courts, but also in the public eye as well.
Just a song? No, you mentioned the word bomb.
Also known for his sharp wit and his stand-up comedy that challenges Muslim stereotypes and anti-Muslim tropes, Mr. Ali took to social media before the hearing, asking his supporters to pray for him to succeed in putting the case against him to rest once and for all. Saeed Pourreza, London.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
A new study says a major system of ocean currents that ferries heat from the tropics to the North Atlantic could shut down far sooner than expected. Such a collapse would prove catastrophic for Earth's climate. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to WEON, an ocean current system responsible for transporting heat from the tropics to the North Atlantic may shut down much earlier than previously thought, with potentially catastrophic consequences for Earth's climate. Recent predictions indicate that an ocean current system known as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, has been weakening as the Earth continues to warm up. Despite this, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, had previously stated that the complete shutdown of the AMOC was not expected to happen within this century. But a new study by a group of researchers from Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen has challenged the notion, suggesting that the AMOC could halt as early as 2025.
Thank you.
findings were published on Tuesday, July 25th, in the journal Nature Communications. Using advanced statistical tools and ocean temperature data from the last 150 years, the researchers calculated that the ocean currents known as the thermohaline circulation or the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, AMOC, will collapse with 95% certainty between 2025 and 2095, the study said. The most probable time for this collapse is estimated to be around 2057. Though some climate scientists urge caution, pointing to the uncertainties in the data that could affect accuracy, the mere possibility of the AMOC shutting down so soon remains deeply concerning. The AMOC, which includes the Gulf Stream, plays a crucial role in carrying heat away from the tropics. Without it, the tropics would experience rapid temperature increases and disruption of vital tropical rains, with severe impacts on the environments of regions such as South America, Western Africa, India, and other parts of South Asia. Shutting down the AMOC can have very serious consequences for Earth's climate, for example, by changing heat wave and precipitation are disturbed globally. While a cooling of Europe may seem less severe as the globe as a whole becomes warmer and heat waves occur more frequently, this shutdown will contribute to an increased warming of the tropics, where rising temperatures have already given rise to challenging living conditions, Professor Peter Ditlevsen from the Niels Bohr Institute said in an official statement. Furthermore, northern and western Europe would lose its supply of warm water from the tropics, leading to increased storms and extremely cold winters in those areas. The absence of the Gulf Stream would also result in rising sea levels along the eastern seaboard of the United States. The website of Earth Sky also noted, "We don't often see a scientific paper that uses the word warning in its title, but a new paper published on July 25, 2023 in the prestigious journal Nature does use that word. It describes an imminent collapse of a key system of ocean currents due to global warming. The paper is titled Warning of a Forthcoming Collapse of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. And this paper says the collapse could come as early as 2025. The ocean currents of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, as known as AMOC, help transport heat around the globe, so they are a key factor in a wide variety of weather and climate conditions. A collapse of this system of currents could cause a precipitous drop in temperatures in Europe, including Scandinavia. It could raise sea level on the U.S. East Coast, and it could disrupt rainfall that billions of people depend on for food in India, South America, and West Africa. The new calculations come from scientists at the University of Copenhagen. Peter Ditlevsen of the university's Niels Bohr Institute led the study and told The Guardian, "I think we should be very worried. This would be a very, very large change. The AMOC has not been shut off for 12,000 years. The shutdown could come as early as 2025, the scientists found, or as late as 2095, with the greatest probability occurring around the year 2057, if current greenhouse gas emissions persist. These new results contradict the latest report from the IPCC, which suggested the AMOC would not shut down until sometime in the 22nd century. As always, not everyone agrees on the exact timing, but there has been evidence prior to this that the currents in the AMOC system are vulnerable to climate change, and there is widespread acknowledgement that a change in these currents would change Earth's weather. David Thornalley at University College London told The Guardian that the study had large caveats and unknowns. He said further research was essential, but he said, if the statistics are robust and a relevant way to describe how the actual AMOC behaves, then this is a very concerning result. The researchers' prediction relies on observations of what they called early warning signals that ocean currents exhibit as they become unstable. These early warning signals for the thermohaline circulation had been reported previously. However, according to these scientists, it's only now become possible to predict when a collapse will occur, thanks to the development of advanced statistical methods. Susan Ditlevsen of the University of Copenhagen's Department of Math Sciences, the new study's co-author, said, using new and improved statistical tools, we've made calculations that provide a more robust estimate of when a collapse of the AMOC is most likely to occur. This is something we had not been able to do before. They said the thermohaline circulation has operated in its present mode since the last iceberg, which ended approximately 11,000 years ago. During that ice age, the circulation of these ocean currents did indeed collapse. Abrupt climate jumps between the present state of the AMOC and the collapse state has been observed to happen 25 times in connection with ice age climate. These are the famed Dansgaard-Oseager events, first observed in ice cores from the Greenlandic ice sheet. At those events, climate changes were extreme with 10 to 15 degrees Celsius changes over a decade. Meanwhile, the present day's climate change is 1.5 degrees Celsius, warming over a century.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The United Nations is reporting that 2023 is already the deadliest year for Palestinians being killed by the Israeli regime since it started keeping records in 2006. Violence has been rampant against the native people of the land, and Over 200 Palestinians have been killed so far this year. The regime continues to destroy more Palestinian homes and take their lands as they increase the construction of illegal settlements. However, pressure is mounting on the regime from many different directions. Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Saad Nim, professor of political science at Birzeit University, Ramallah. And Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let me start it off in Ramallah. Saad, when the United Nations issues such reports, what does it really mean if an international body is just pointing out the obvious but not trying to stop the source of the problem? What good does it do?
Good evening to you and to your guest also, Nick. Well, we know that the Israeli regime, and especially nowadays with this government, which is very far right wing government, and the two major ministers are settlers themselves. So definitely the action of this government will be more and more atrocities against Palestinians. It's quite obvious that also the international community, as you mentioned, is not doing anything that could help the Palestinian apart from, you know, condemnation or just expressing their concern about what's going on. But in reality, they are doing nothing. Next month, which, this month, September, we have as many sessions of the United Nations to address the issue of the Palestinian question. But we know that the international community so far is not going to do anything about it, since they are not, you know, willing really to take measures against Israel, like, you know, boycotting or to treat them exactly as any other country around the world. But the double standard and the hypocrisy of the international community is a dominant factor here, which will prevent them of doing anything against Israel when it concerns the Palestinians.
Well, Mick, we have seen these apartheid forces killing more Palestinians, initiating more violent night raids and destroying more Palestinians' homes. Is this due to desperation on the part of the regime that it cannot control the momentum of the Palestinian resistance, or is it from sheer arrogance?
I think it's to do with decades and decades of complete impunity, mass killings in Cast Lead and Protective Edge, many massacres in between, all of which have gone unpunished. Many of them have been condemned in words by the United Nations and sometimes even by the United States when they felt they had no alternative. But they've gone unpunished and Israel only respects force. And you know, the United Nations has produced many excellent reports concluding that Israel is an apartheid state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, the one co-authored by Richard Falk a few years ago, which was suppressed by the UN under great pressure from the USA. The Israelis, I mean, talk about impunity. The UN publishes an annual list of shame of countries which have been abusing children during wartime. But Israel was not on the list this year, and it was not on previous lists, even though we have lots of examples of children being used as human shields, children being killed, children being arrested and so on, and abused in a way that no civilized society could tolerate. So, yes, Israel enjoys complete impunity. And I think we have to connect that over many decades to the current regime. As Saad Nimmer mentions, with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are openly murderous, who've thrown over all the traces. I mean, whereas previous governments tried to cover their behaviour with a fig leaf, I mean, Saad and his friends and comrades in the West Bank could be arrested at any time by soldiers and a military administration. They could go to a court, which had 100% virtually guilty verdicts, and they had no chance whatsoever of justice. But Israel went through the forms of a democracy and the forms of a justice system. I think because they've got away with so much for so long, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, really, they've thrown all caution to the winds. And Ben-Gvir, of course, had a photograph of Goldstein on his wall, the guy who massacred scores of worshippers in the Al-Khalil Mosque. And, you know, he's now in charge of the police force. So they've thrown over all the traces. They have an open bloodlust, whereas previously we had very cultured and very rational ethnic cleansers who would try to carry out the whole thing with a kind of political cover and look towards America for limitations on what they did. This current generation, I think they have decided that they don't need to fear the so-called international community, the United Nations, because they look at the history and say, we get away with massacres anyway, so why bother placating them?
Okay. Well, Saad, Mick talked about Palestinian kids. I want to open that up a little bit more, because we've seen continued aggression against the children, intimidation, being arrested. It's as if the regime is either totally fearful of the future, are just totally losing control. I mean, your assessment of this side of things and why the kids are being targeted more and more.
Well, first of all, I don't think that they are fearing of the future so far, at least for now. But they are, revealing their real face. As Mick has mentioned, previous governments, they tried to cover it up a little bit, but with this government, it's quite obvious, and they don't need even to cover it up. They reveal the real face of this kind of regime, this colonialist, racist regime. Now, the thing about the children, in particularly, the Israeli, they have different laws concerning the children in Israel and the children in the West Bank and Gaza. For the children in Israel, we know that everyone knows around the world, 18 years old, you are and under, it's a child. But in Palestine, they have three categories, 12 to 14, 14 to 16, 16 to 18. Starting with the last one, 16 to 18 is a full adult and he will face directly whatever any kind of atrocities by the regime, like arresting and trying and taking to court and even kept in adults' prisons. Now 12 to 14 they can arrest him but not try him yet, so they wait till he became 14, and after 14 the law allows them to try him in the court, like the what happened with this with the person from Jerusalem, who was 13 when he was arrested, and they kept him in prison till he became 14, and then he was sentenced after he became 14. So this is a kind of two laws in regarding the children. So the abuse of the children is really very high, and till now we are talking about 35 child were killed by the Israeli from the beginning of this year. Now, why they are doing that? Because they don't care. Basically, they don't see the Palestinians as humans. Dehumanizing the Palestinians is one of the things that the Israeli are really masters in. And they don't care. And they don't even, think about children or non-children or whoever, when it comes to the Palestinian. They treat us not like as a human. They don't think it twice. Their hand on the trigger is very light. And they can, use the weapon immediately against any Palestinian at any under any kind of circumstances. Regardless, they can, make sure that it's what's going on or not. Like the guy who was killed, and they said he had a weapon in his hand, and apparently he had a bottle of water. And because of that, they thought it is a weapon and they killed him. After that, they make sure that it was a bottle of water. So it's so easy for them, because the main issue here is the dehumanize the Palestinians. This is on the one side. On the other side, they feel that they are the only victims in this conflict. And if you are the only victim, so you blame even us as Palestinians for killing the children. See what you make us do? We are killing our children now because because they don't want to see that there are any other victims but them. They are only the victims. And lastly, the Israeli deeply believe that they are the chosen people and they have the right to do whatever they like to do whenever it needs to do. So with these kind of myths in their heads, definitely they will live, normally with what they are doing in killing the Palestinians. So it's kind of normal in this kind of a state. And this government just revealed the real face of the state. Maybe we started to see now how ugly it was because of these ministers and because of this government. But in reality, since the beginning, since 1948, when it was established, or let me say, since the Zionist movement was established, it is a racist movement from day one when it was established.
Yeah, unbelievable. I'm just listening to you, and I'm remembering the case of Ahmed Manasra, who was 14, I believe, and I think it's been about 7 or 8 years that he has been in Israeli prisons, unfortunately, hopefully, that he can be freed soon. Mick, we look at Zionism, which is a racist ideology, and we've seen continuous examples of the racism and discrimination against Palestinians, but not only do the Palestinians experience this racism, but non-European Western Jews also experience this type of discrimination. Yesterday we saw an incident with some Africans from Eritrea, but we've seen other cases, the Ethiopian Jews who experience actually unbelievable discrimination of the regime. I mean, isn't this indicative in general of just a racist apartheid regime all around?
Look, I don't have the vocabulary in order to explain the intensity of Israeli racism. It is far and away the most racist society on the surface of the earth, and the competition is quite extreme. Eli Yishai, an Israeli minister of the interior, not a drunk in a pub, he said that the problem with Muslims, and he had many problems with Muslims, probably that they existed was a problem for him, but he said the problem is that Muslims don't accept that Israel is a white man's country. The Minister of the Interior, the top man in the government to deal with citizens in terms of justice. Israel has a history of Jewish supremacy over all non-Jews in the whole land of Palestine. But within that, it has a very developed history of European supremacy against non-European Jews. And it's very long-standing. It's there from the very beginning. It's quite undeniable once you look at the history. The guy who's known as the father of settlement in the land of Israel, Arthur Rupin, who did more than anybody else to dispossess Palestinians in the early years of the Zionist project, he used to measure Jewish noses to prove that European Jews were superior to Iraqi and Yemeni and Middle Eastern Jews. He was an absolutely determined Jewish supremacist and a white supremacist as well. Yemeni children have been kidnapped by the hundred, probably the thousands. And there's many Jewish Yemenis who cry to this day. They were kidnapped when they came to Palestine as Zionists and taken from their mothers in the hospitals and given to European Jews to bring them up as Europeans. Kidnapping, stealing, telling the mothers the children were dead, and the people are alive to this day in Israel, knowing that their children have been stolen from them because they, the Yemenis, were deemed to be inferior to Europeans. And also, I mean, black African Jews, they suffer racist supremacy as well. Not only in Israel, but we have a huge problem of racism in Britain. But I tell you, here, you could not get demonstrations at schools because one black child was going to be admitted to the school. You get that in Israel. The intensity of some sections of the Jewish population towards black children is extreme. Now, if you add all these together, you get a picture of popular racism in Israel, which I think it's important to explain. I mean, popular racism is not from the state. The state contributes to it by dispossessing Palestinians. It's a very racist state indeed. But popular racism is not exactly the same. I mean, in America, black people were lynched and murdered in popular public parties where people would drink alcohol, hundreds would gather, and they would kill a black person or two and hang them from trees very publicly. This didn't happen to Jews even in Nazi Germany. So popular racism in Israel is extreme. It, of course, the main victims are Palestinians by a royal mile, but Yemeni Jews, black people, people who other minorities as well, they suffer from the racism of a settler colonial state, because a settler colonial state must imbue the dominant, the supremacist population with the most extreme racism, because you cannot dispossess and steal from people their land, their lives, without making the dominant population hate them and deal with them as subhuman. Mm. If I may make a final point, if I may, mm-hmm. before the rise of the slave trade in Britain, you didn't, in Europe, you didn't have the same kind of racism that you got after the slave trade. It's because black people were bought and sold as like dogs that racism needed to follow. And I think that explains much of the popular racism in the most racist society in the world.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Saad, this has been the 35th week of protests against the Netanyahu regime on Saturday and its judicial reforms. One of the speakers who spoke at the demonstration in Tel Aviv said, quote, "Whenever you look, the madness, the fanaticism, the Masonic extremism, all these sick evils are only increasing." Your thoughts on her assessment?
Yes, now Israel is in a big problem regarding what's going on in the last few months when Netanyahu is trying now to change the laws. And we are talking about something like around 200 laws which he need to change. He started with only one last month, but now he's also intending to do, though he said that he's going to postpone the whole thing. But in reality, the Israeli public do know that he's a liar, and he's not going to change his mind about it, because his life is about that. Changing the law, it means that he would try to escape the trial, because he's charged with three major charges, and he might be imprisoned because of that. So he wanted to be prime minister as much as he could till he changed the laws, which will allow him to continue in his political life. So he don't care about Israel. He don't care about even anyone else, because he wants just to save his neck by changing the laws. And the Israeli do know that if he started to meddle in the laws and in the judicial system in Israel, it means that they are not talking about democracy anymore at all. Though I don't think at all that Israel is a democracy, but still they are trying to project that in front of the whole international community that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, which is really, really not true. But at least, they think, or they want to believe that their country is a democracy. And what is going on, It's going to hinder this kind of democracy. Now, the implication of these demonstrations so far, after 35 weeks of continuous demonstrations, now we started to see that the Likud party, Netanyahu's party, is starting also to send his own supporters in order sometimes to have clashes with the demonstrators, not necessarily in Tel Aviv, but in other cities where demonstrators are a little bit smaller in amount. However, But the other implications are really, really very important, and we have to look at them really carefully, because we are talking about, you know, a huge sector of the pilots in Israel are refusing to join and to join the army, and especially in the reserve. And they declare it, more than 500 pilots, they declare that they are not going to join the training or anything else, which, you know, many reports saying that the Israeli army and some of the officers in the Israeli army, they are saying that we are facing, you know, some problems because of these kind of decisions, not only by pilots, but also other high-rank officers who refuse also to join the training and to join, you know, the army. So all that will put, you know, Israel definitely in a kind of real turmoil and a big problem, and all that because of Netanyahu and his own personal opinion about the law.
Well, Mick, there is growing anxiety amongst the Zionist population, however. According to a poll by an Israeli TV station, more than 28% of those polled say they are considering leaving there to go to another country, and more than 56% believe that a civil war is possible. What do you make of these results?
I say excellent. For 35 weeks now, we've seen a major clash between two Zionist blocs, between those who wish to create a second Nakba immediately, very quickly, and finish what started in 1948, we can say. And the other bloc, which gazes into that with horror and wishes to continue with business as usual. I mean, I spoke to an Israeli at the Edinburgh Festival last week who was putting on a play telling the truth about the Israeli army, the brutality, the racism, etc. And he said, look at all these demonstrations on the street, hundreds of thousands of people. I said, yes, but they're fighting about how to crush the Palestinians. He said, yeah, OK, that's true. And he quickly agreed that Israel had never been a democracy. It had been a democracy with voting rights for Jews, but not for Palestinians. And I think the possibility of the Zionist bloc splitting and the possibility of extreme tension can possibly lead to a weakening of the Israeli state. And this state, which has strode the Middle East as the regional dominant power for a very long time, crushed the Arab armies in 67 and so on, anything which weakens that state has to be something that we should welcome. And the Palestinians toiling and suffering under that state may well benefit from it becoming weaker. And the possibility of a civil war, I think there's already an incipient civil war, because the old elite who are opposed to Netanyahu, the European white elite, the people who control the highest levels of the economy, of the army, and so on, they don't want to surrender to Netanyahu's base, which isn't the old elite and wants to challenge that old elite. And I think there's something very fundamental going on. And my final point would be, if the